Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Begonia and the Baltimoreans, starting with Begonia. Okay, so we start off with bees. Mike, where do you want to, how do you want to set up this extremely weird new collaboration between Emma Stone and this very odd director?
Yeah, this really is the very place to start. The director, Yorgos Lanthimos, sort of made a career of making weird movies. I've got to say, he's a divisive figure in the sense that his advocates tend to be fanatical, how much they love him. I'm not quite as enthusiastic there, though I find him really distinctive and quirky and interesting and all those good things. I watch every minute of every movie he makes. My main reservation is this. I think in some of his earlier work and throughout the body of work, he's strange for the sake of being strange sometimes. I just feel like sometimes, you know, it's a neat visual effect or thematically curious, but then what am I to make of it? And this is the case with Begonia as well, where I feel like sometimes as a director, he's doing what I call yanking the chain, that he'll sort of lead the audience to a certain thought line and or certain assumptions and then sort of pull the carpet out from under you that way. And I appreciate that creatively, but sometimes you feel like you're being manipulated unfairly even. But maybe I'm jumping the gun a bit there because I should lead up to why I feel that way about this film as well. And to Marie's earlier point, and it's crucial, this is the fourth collaboration between this director and Emma Stone. So they have really a great working relationship. And there have been times with films like Poor Things where it's really paid off critically and commercially. And, you know, you can see why they have that strong bond. Now, the only thing I want to say at the moment is that I'm always really careful with spoilers or if there's going to be a spoiler alert, alerting you to the alert as it lies ahead. But and I think particularly in the case of Begonia, there's very little one can say securely in that respect beyond about the first 20 minutes or 30 minutes of the film. So the best I can do, I think, in this case, in all fairness to our audience, is to indicate the premise. It is a nifty premise. I love the premise of the launching pad, if you will. Namely, you have Jesse Plemons playing a beekeeper. He and his cousin live a rather isolated existence. And as we know, bees are dying off. And there's some scientific research on this, of course, but also a lot of mystery, like why is this happening kind of thing. And it leads one to speculate. Now, what happens here is that the beekeeper, he starts to formulate what I'll call conspiracy theories. What's behind this? What's causing this? And once you go down that rabbit hole, you almost never come back out of it, right? And what I find intriguing about the premise here is what I think of as conspiracy theories in the internet age. Because as he gathers evidence and looks for things, oh, well, I found this on Instagram or there was a YouTube video, whatever. And I don't want to like slam bang, just condemn all those things, but they have a tendency to accelerate whatever thought process would be there already. In other words, it's more fuel for the fire, if you want to put it that way. So what happens here is a twofold conspiracy theory operation. Ultimately, two folds become one fold. The first fold is thinking that something's wrong with our bees. They're dying. What's behind it. Okay, so you go down that rabbit hole. And then in very fragmentary fashion, initially, the film gives some family backstory, back history, if you will. What's in his own personal background with his mother and just his relationships with family and so on. And initially, it's so fragmentary, it's deliberately confusing even. It's just like, what? Well, you know, like for 10 seconds, you see a black and white flashback to something. What is this? And then you quickly realize that whatever the family backstory is going to be directly linked to that initial beekeeping worry. And where the blame ultimately lies in terms of the suspicion, if you will, is that he is blaming a corporate CEO, and this is the character played by Emma Stone, that she must be behind this. And there's a kind of crazy logic, or maybe not even crazy to it, namely that she's the high-powered CEO of a company that makes biochemicals. And maybe her chemicals are somehow responsible for what's happening to the bees. And who knows, maybe even with his mother, where there was some sort of clinical trial, medical test, you know, you can fill in the blanks as best you can here. And that's all really quite interesting. Now, Without spoiling anything, the film, and this is not surprising for a Yorgos Lanthimos film, is going to really push it in a certain direction. But some of that payoff, some of those revelations and so on, you really need as a viewer to discover for yourself. Now, I saw the film I was hosting the film for a film club, and the audience was very divided on this very point. And I think our audience will be as well, as to do you go along with where the film is taking you. So with that, I turn it over to you, and now you can take it and you can spoil it if you want.
Well, I'm going to only spoil it a little, only because the trailers that went out gave people a really big heads up. And before I heard anything about the movie, just that about the director and, you know, his ongoing mentorship in a way of Emma Stone, I thought, oh, that's going to be interesting. But my friend said, so is the point of the movie to try to figure out whether Emma Stone's character is an alien or whether Emma Stone herself is an alien? And I thought, whoa, I don't know. So I kind of went into the movie with that question in my mind. I agree with everything you said about it's a great looking movie. It has a lot of technical things going for it. It's got comedy where you wouldn't expect comedy. I don't think it's as good as or as creative as Poor Things, but it's a remake of a Korean movie. I found this out while we were at a meeting, Mike, you were sitting right with me, that it's based on a Korean movie called Save the Green Planet. So I did happen to get a hold of this movie and watch it. Just watching it, I kind of knew what was going on because I'd seen Bugonia. What do you think about that in terms of it being, you know, the original property being remade?
I was initially not surprised so much as struck by the fact that Yorgos Lanthimos is a really original director, for better or for worse. But certainly when he gets done with it, it's his film. You know, you don't feel like it's a slavish remake at all. But then as I thought about it more, I thought, well, you know what, this is, and again, we can safely say this without spoiling anything unduly, it is a sci-fi picture, remaking kind of sort of another sci-fi picture. And when I was talking about the film with that film club audience I mentioned before, again, we're academics, so we put things in a film history context. But the context I put it in was Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, which is one of my favorite sci-fi films and such a 50s film in so many ways. But, you know, if you're living in a nice, safe, suburban or quasi-rural environment and everything's nice and normal, then you think maybe things aren't so normal. And if you know, one of your friends tells you, well, you know, my Uncle Ira is not quite himself these days. And then you see him, there's Uncle Ira smoking his pipe and pushing a lawnmower and all this normal stuff. But the relative's insistence, you know, he looks the same and he talks the same. Something's different. Something's off. I always am intrigued by that kind of sci-fi premise. If everything seems normal in your world and the aliens are infiltrating, how would you know it? And it seems to me thematically, it's one of the great sci-fi tropes. And definitely informs Bugonia. It's just the sense, because the Emma Stone character, when I say she's high powered and she has kind of take no prisoners approach and all, she may well be a monster of some sort. Whether she's actually an alien is the big question in the film. But she's not the nicest person, right? Even when she tells people, oh, it's 5:30, you know, you can go home now, unless you still have work to do, in which case you should stay. And Emma Stone's really good at playing that. She's so cold-blooded in a lot of ways and heartless and all. You almost do start to think along the lines of, now the thing about pod people is that they tend to be like passive and they've been taken over and controlled. She's not quite that kind of, if she is, I don't want to say she is or she isn't. She's a different kind of creature, if you will, because if indeed she is something other than human or fully human, she has like a wicked IQ and wit and powers that way. So she's not like, just like some robotic thing. She's the opposite of that, actually. And this is where the film goes into, I think, a broader critique, which, again, I think works quite well within it. Because if you think about the production design, her corporate headquarters, you know, it's all glass walled and sleek and shiny and, you know, everybody in their appropriate business attire and all. But it's that kind of like almost Stanley Kubrick environment of just, you know, how cold and how alienating the work environment is. And she's the perfect CEO for something like that. So what I like so much about those early sections of the film is just simply watching her as she goes about her routine business activity, just to watch her go down a corridor or sit at her desk and stare out. As a viewer, I'm sitting there thinking, well, I don't know. You know, like, is she an alien the way this guy is insisting? Because he's so sure of it. Or is he just totally nuts? And she may be dislikable in other ways, but she's a human being you can hate. She's not an alien you can hate. And the film plays that really well, I think. And so I was like totally mesmerized watching it because I'm looking for clues. We all are, right? And where I'm determined not to spoil anything whatsoever is just that as the film moves along, it's going to clarify certain issues one way or another. And that's where I think the audience will be split. And at a gut level, you know, do you buy it? Do you accept where the film is taking you? And where is it taking you even? That's where in our film club discussion, people were thinking, you know, without spoiling anything, wondering, well, what are we to make of all this? What's the takeaway, if you will? And I'm generally reluctant to have reductive takeaways, like in two sentences, here's what the movie means. But this is a case where I think the director is better at setting up something like this than he is at resolving it.
Very well put. I will say that the main thing that I did not care for was the level of violence. There was a lot of blood and gore that I just had to look away from. I can see why it was part of the plot or maybe even necessary, but I personally just felt like that went too far. The scene that I thought was awesome and hilarious was that, you know, the way to summon the mothership is with a calculator. It was so ridiculous and yet kind of genius. And talk about like the purloined letter kind of thing. Something that doesn't even seem like recent technology is somehow given a chance to be more than you thought it was, which I thought was a nice metaphor. I wanted to mention, I thought all of the acting performances were fantastic, but I want to ask you what you thought of the cop character, because I found him so engaging. And yet, you know, there's this encroaching dread that happens every time he shows up.
Well, I like what you're saying there in terms of this is a really clever director, and there's a kind of quirky, funny combination of low tech and high tech, right? And so it's the point you were making, and they have a lot of fun with that because the movie is, you know, even leave aside the sci-fi, but it's still like looking towards futuristic design, and her company actually is sort of like leading the way with research and this and that. So it sort of looks forward in a quasi sci-fi way. And yet, without again spoiling anything, there are some crucial plot points where people rely on low-tech devices or means or something. And that's, it's meant to be funny. And this director, one of the ways in which it's destabilizing, and I mean this as a compliment here, is just that, you know, you have certain assumptions or expectations, but you can never like settle into them completely because this film's going to keep you a bit off balance that way as a viewer. Secondly, I also agree strongly with you that although the violence is warranted in terms of the storyline that I otherwise don't discuss, it's so extreme in places, and it was splatterfest kind of extreme. And I think if we're speaking against the director on this, maybe we're speaking also against audience taste even. It seems like nowadays a lot of films feel the need to go there.
Do you think there were any other highlights that might garner any Academy Award nominations for this film?
That's a really good question, because this is certainly in technical categories, it would. It's a very well-acted film. Can I add one more reservation to the many I've already registered here? Even though there's so much cleverness in the scripting in so many ways, it's sometimes frustrating even beyond how it's meant to be frustrating. And this is where I'm doubling back on your third or fourth point, which had to do with the sheriff character. This beekeeper's troubled past, and I won't say more about his mother and this and that, but the troubled past there, something happened years in the past where the guy who's now the sheriff was his babysitter. And, you know, something, you know, bad, you know, back then. And the sheriff, and so when the sheriff pulls him over at one point, you think, uh-oh, you know, he's being suspected of this. But it's just simply a sheriff's is like, hey, buddy, how you been kind of thing. And as an audience member, this is where the screenplay itself seems incomplete or where it's yanking the chain, as I say, because that sheriff character doesn't really add up to or amount to much. And it's not as well acted or played as some of the other scenes. It seems kind of forced to me, actually, that, you know, when the beekeeper himself becomes a suspect in various ways, that the sheriff suddenly will pop up at the front door knocking, hey, can I come in? Boy, that cake looks good. Can I have a slice of cake? Kind of thing. And some of that's funny and meant to be funny. Some of it just to me seems really rather forced and incomplete in the screenplay even. At some point, not that you have to fully satisfy your audience by serving them the slice of cake metaphorically, but you need to do something there so you feel like it was worth it. Here, I felt like they're dangling things our way and then not fully resolving them. And to me, it just seems at that point that the screenplay sets up a lot of things and doesn't quite know how to pull them off or opts not to pull them off. What do you think there? I think the writing is kind of wobbly at times.
I agree. I wonder if there were things cut out of the film to keep it shorter, because I agree. There's things that it made you start questioning things, but then it didn't go anywhere.
Well, the movie runs in exactly 120 minutes, and I have to do some research as to whether there was a longer cut or this or that. My gut reaction is I think this is exactly the film he wants to give us. It's just I don't think the film's giving us everything it should there. So I didn't have the feeling that things had dropped out or been cut out. I just had the feeling they weren't there to begin with.
Yeah, you could be right about that. All right, so let's move on to The Baltimoreans. Man walks into a dentist's office on Christmas Eve. And I want to set up from the beginning that they paid only like $45 getting shooting permits from the city. So talk about low budget.
Well, this is a case where The Baltimoreans is very much a locally made film. It's very much a low budget film. There are a lot of interesting anecdotes attached here to locations they got for free or low cost, whatever. And indeed, it helps explain why so many of the scenes take place in a car with people driving, because you can shoot that for $2.50, right? You don't need anything too elaborate to do that. This is a case of where, because it has such a strong local connection, Michael Strassner, who is the co-writer of the film and who's the star of it, is a Baltimore kid. And he's now 36, but a Baltimore kid and real strong local connections. And so this was a film he wanted to make in his hometown. And where I have mixed to negative feelings about the film is in the sense that, yeah, I mean, I'm a Baltimore kid, too. I love seeing local spots like that, all the location work and so on. But my feeling is because of that sort of heartfelt hometown interest, there's a sort of built-in boosterism here. A lot of people, I think, have responded well to the film because they want to be supportive. They're like inclined to like it, I went in with that expectation. And I think, though, I got to be honest here, I think it's a really weak film. I think it's weak in all sorts of ways. And I've had some, quasi-arguments with people over it. The basis for it biographically, it is very true to his own life. And I'm not spoiling anything here in the sense that was a Baltimore kid who then eventually went out to L.A., did some TV work, Parks and Recreation, Blackish, and things. He's got some credits that way. But essentially, it's true to his life. So what I'm not spoiling is at the very beginning of the film, the character Cliff, played by Michael Strassner, has a suicide attempt. And I mean, it's right at the top of the film, so I'm not spoiling that. That mirrors a real life suicide attempt that Michael Strassner had in 2018. And the entire film is quasi-autobiographical, that he was a stand-up comic, improv comedy, but an alcoholic. And this is where now in the screenplay that he co-wrote with Jay Duplass, this is where I think the film really suffers. And here I will, even though like for our show today, I've been deliberately avoiding spoilers. Today, I will deliberately at this moment give a spoiler because there's no way I can describe why the film is so weak without spoiling that. So here's the premise. The character of Cliff, as an alcoholic, is also successful, at least on the local comedy club circuit. He can get up in front of a crowd and make them laugh and this and that, but he needs a drink, right? He always, and performers can be that way, right? He needs that drink to get the courage or the whatever to get up on stage. And so he's able to do that successfully. Once he comes off the suicide attempt and AA programs and all that, he's sober and so on. His anxiety, his real worry as a character is, okay, now that I'm straight, now that I'm clean and no longer an alcoholic. Well, you're always an alcoholic, but now he's no longer drinking and being true to his AA credentials at this point. Okay, can he still do stand up, or could he do stand up again? Because he's retired from the comedy scene, the improv scene. Can he do it sober? That's the crucial thematic question here. There's a linked romantic consideration we'll talk about, but can he perform sober? Now, very near the end of the film, and here's the spoiler, so turn it off now if you want. There's an extended club scene. And I mean, it really goes on a long, long time. And the whole point of it thematically is, now that he's sober and doing stand-up again after all this time, these people in the audience who knew him from back in the day and all, they're going to be supportive and all. But when he does that routine near the end of the film, the audience within the film is cracking up. They're laughing. It goes over really well. I was stone-faced. I thought, this guy's simply not funny. He's not funny drunk. He's not funny sober. I mean, it really failed thematically at that point. And this is where I think a really fundamental flaw here, the character, and I don't know the actor whatsoever. I don't have an axe to grind at all there, but the character Cliff is meant to be irritating, deliberately irritating, but in an endearing way. You know, he's the kind of guy, he comes into the room, he makes bad jokes, this and that, he insults people, this and that, but you can't help loving the guy, right? He's supposed to be like irritating but endearing. I just found him irritating. I just found him so, so aggravating that I just wanted to get away from him that way. And that doesn't help in terms of audience identification or empathy. So that's my major gripe with the film. There's a secondary gripe, which has to do with that Baltimore boosterism. And goodness knows I'm a booster too. But for a film that is just loaded with location work, I mean, so many spots that I go by every day. I mean, I know the turf here. Because so often they're in a car going from here to there, it makes absolutely no geographic sense. So if you're going to do like an intensely local film, we'll be true to that. I mean, if we want to get to the granular level, I could go on for 3 hours with this, but it's like you're driving through a particular Baltimore neighborhood, which I know, and then you take a right turn and suddenly you're in a totally different neighborhood on the other side of the city. And then suddenly there's the Washington Monument and there's this and that. It just doesn't make any kind of geographic sense there. And I thought, well, if you really love your city and want to respect it, respect the street grid a little bit more. And here the edit is so arbitrary at times that if you are a true local and you care about these things, it's like, it's ridiculous. So like on the one hand, they care about locations and you know, really endearing locations, speaking of which, you know, the Miracle on 34th Street, the Christmas lights and all that. And yeah, it's great to see that stuff. But then when you see like the way the shots are lined up, it's like edited in a blender sometimes, as to, you know, we're here, we're there, we're this, we're that. And then the third level of disappointment for me, I guess the levels never stop here. I've gone down that rabbit hole. But the third level disappointment is in the romantic relationship. On Christmas Eve, because of a chipped tooth, he needs to find a dentist pronto. He finds one, Dee Dee, played by Liz Larson. This is where the film is borderline implausible in so many ways. And I'm making an allowance here for what I call it the screwball comedy allowance. In a screwball comedy, there's a lot of ridiculous daffy. Oh, come on now. You have to go with it at a certain point. Here I found myself resisting it in terms of, you know, she would be open and willing to take a patient on Christmas Eve. He has all kinds of problems with his car being towed and this and that. Sort of like Scorsese's After Hours, one thing after another, you know, late at night. But that she would go along with all these things, and that, you know, despite their differences demographically and certainly in terms of age, she's considerably older and so on, that she would fall for this guy. You know, he's lonely and quasi-suicidal and this and that. She's divorced. She's an older woman. She's, you know, perhaps receptive to something new like this. But of all the guys in the world you could take up with, would she take up with this guy? And once they take up together, and initially they do spar back and forth. I don't want to, you know, shortchange that. But before you know it, they are going to be a quasi couple, if I can call it that. And at that point, I'm just thinking, I don't know. I mean, in terms of not just the street directions, but the direction of the relationship, it just seems really forced to me and not convincing whatsoever. So, you know, as a Baltimore kid, I should have loved so much here. And I find myself turning against the film. I just think it's really weak.
Wow. I couldn't agree less. I loved this movie. I was completely bought into the relationship. But I liked the fact that it started off, you know, like every good screwball comedy, that these people are completely unlikely. And of course, they're never going to get together, even though, you know, that's where they're going to try to make it go. I loved all the scenes that Baltimore did not think at all about, you know, well, if you turn here, this isn't really where you end up. I was so struck by the scene where you see the Key Bridge, you know, there it was. They didn't know when they filmed it, it was what was going to happen. Loved all the lights on 34th Street. I think it was such a smart decision to film at that time when all those lights were up, because it would cost a fortune to do it if it wasn't Christmas. Now, having said all that, there were some things that I was like, oh, come on. One of them being, there's an improv going on Christmas Eve in Baltimore. I don't think so. I found that hard to believe. I also thought they tried really hard to make sure we liked the Cliff character. And I think they could have just let him be that sort of Charles Grodin, Richard Dreyfuss kind of guy. It took me a while to like him, but once I got to know the character a little bit, I thought they did a really good job of, you know, showing you that this wasn't just some goofball, that he had a backstory that you could appreciate. I was also taken by the lead actress, because I thought, I know it's not Edie Falco, but I'm just kind of getting Edie Falco. So, I mean, those were the things that stood out to me. I mean, they had me at 40 minutes in when they, you know, referenced burger cookies.
Part of me understands that for sure. I love the name check quality to it, which is not just geographic, but also burger cookies and all sorts of. But to me, after a while, that seemed, frankly, just kind of arbitrary, like insert local reference here. And so on the one hand, I could enjoy it like I enjoy a burger cookie. But the thing is, like with a burger cookie, you can only eat one, you know, because if you eat a second one, it's like a brick in your stomach. And I felt like this film was a brick in my stomach. It just was too much piled on that way. But I got to ask you just to push back on this, when he has his triumphant return engagement with improv comedy, did you think he was funny?
I thought he was honest.
Well, honest isn't the same as funny.
No, it's not. But I thought, you know, given that he was trying to work through his fear, I felt like it was an honest look at what that would look like if that's who you were at that point.
As a customer, would you have been satisfied if you had paid to see it?
I would have been interested in what was going on. Not necessarily laughing, but
I mean, you paid to go to a comedy club and this is what the guy's doing on stage.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It doesn't hold up as a great comedy routine, but it holds up as what would happen if you're that character and you do that at that time.
But then what would he do for his next show?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I know the answer. I don't know that I think he needed to go back to improv.
I don't want a sequel, believe me.
Well, I will say this, Mike. You probably are not the person every Christmas that, you know, trots out all of the Hallmark movies that are all rom-coms. I really enjoyed this as a Christmas movie, thinking, oh, this is about grown-ups with complicated lives, not young, beautiful people who are going to find other young, beautiful people in a snowy area and they're going to go ice skating. I appreciated the difference there.
Well, one of the better aspects of the film is actually a kind of demographic diversity. Some of the secondary characters, if you will, there's a more real or grungier or just, you know, warts and all kind of quality to some of the other people, the relatives, if you will. When you go to somebody's house for the holidays, who's going to be there and how do they treat each other? Not always so well. So some of that did have a sort of verisimilitude to it. You know, the cringe factor, if you will, of, you know, an uncomfortable holiday visit with relatives you're not really getting along with all that well, that kind of stuff. Some of that actually I thought was more promising material within the film. And I think there are moments like that. There's scenes like that that I think do work. I just feel like the material is really being forced. And, you know, the thing about it is I can make allowances for screwball comedies because I love so many of them. But at some point, a screwball comedy needs to be funny. And I just didn't find this very funny.
Well taken. I didn't actually think of it as so much as something that was supposed to make me laugh. But that, you know, did I find these people believable as romantic leads together? And surprisingly, I did. I'm actually looking forward to watching it again.
Ah! Include me out. Include me out.
But that takes us to the end of this episode. But don't forget to check out our other ones at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
Okay, we'll see you then.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed what you just heard, we have a whole universe of podcasts waiting for you. Simply search Dragon Podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also explore our full lineup and discover new shows at podbean.com/dragonpodcasts. That's podbean.com/dragonpodcasts.